on this episode of the C4SO podcast.
I think there are elements of the Acts 2 story that parallels the Genesis 1 story, that the Spirit is hovering and then creates. But there's something that's there that says our distinctives, our cultures are honored and in fact brought as something spiritual, not something to be scared of, not something to be eliminated. But nevertheless, there is empathetic listening in which we are able to receive what somebody who is different, what they say, as a word of the Lord.
Hi, I'm Mickey Lowe.
Hi, I'm Bishop Todd. And
welcome to the C4SO podcast.
Mickey, long time no see. And, I miss you for a lot of reasons, but you're kind of like, I don't know why when I think of you, I think of a cool place like Tampa, Florida.
Oh, because it is, baby. Tampa, Florida. This is where it's at.
It's fun to be starting another series with you.
Yes.
This series entitled Navigating Conflict. And our first guest is one of your colleagues.
That's right. Today, we get a chance to talk to the Reverend Dr. Jin Cho, who is a friend and colleague of ours, who is the canon for racial diversity and justice for the diocese. And he is just a great resource for us as clergy and for really anyone who interacts with him. He is just so wise. And in this conversation, he gives us great encouragement for those of us who are immigrant and or people of color. He just encourages us to share our stories and be honest with the conflicts that we've had to navigate and share them with our white brothers and sisters who are genuinely trying to understand and come alongside us in these struggles. And he really models for us a winsome, a gracious way to do that and be generous with one another and be a safe place for one another to have these conversations when it comes to differences and when it comes to navigating conflicts as different kinds of people.
Yeah, I think anybody who listens to this podcast will gain a lot from our conversation with Jin. But I remember especially being grateful for the work he does to help churches of all kinds, not just C4SO churches or Anglican churches, any of these churches who are trying to have these hard conversations around justice and race. And he, as you say, he does a great job helping us think about how to design and hold those spaces in which difficult but redemptive conversations can happen. So here's our conversation with Jin Cho.
Hi, Todd. Hi, Mickey. Great to be here with you guys.
I'm Mickey's sidekick and happy to be here.
Wow. I think we're a pretty good team.
Okay, then. So, Jin, we know each other because we had, did we have like 7 or 8 years overlap at Holy Trinity in Costa Mesa?
You know, I actually think it was shorter, it feels like it was longer. Like, for good reasons, not for bad reasons. Yeah,
that's cool. I don't know.
All I know is I feel like I watched your kids grow up. But
yes, you did. Yeah. Aww.
So, as kind of as well as we knew the Cho family, I don't know the answer to this question. So, if you think of Esther and the kids, what do they most love to tease you about? We just want to help the audience get to know you a little bit. What do you get teased about at home?
Yeah, this is a good one because, and you know this about us, Todd, we are a pretty musical family.
Yes,
Esther is pretty musical. Our kids are both very musical. I like to think of myself as being musical. I participated, gave them half my genes to the kids. But the kids and Esther are musical to another level than me, and they love to tease how not musical I am. So they will actually, one of the games that we will play over dinner is, Dad, what key is this in? And they'll play a song, and they know this. And I'm like, wow. I have no clue. So
that's awesome.
So this is awful. Yeah.
So, Jin, what do you play? Do you play an instrument, or do you like to sing?
I like to think I sing and play the guitar. I play the guitar.
Okay.
But I am more, I think of myself nowadays more as a producer of my family's music.
Yeah. Okay. Hey, that's very
important.
Yeah.
Oh, that's great.
Yeah. That's very important.
So, Jin, I think when we met, you were doing your doctoral dissertation at Fuller, if I remember right.
Yes.
And so just as a way to get into this topic today, where, you know, this is a part of our series on navigating conflict, and we're talking to you today about issues of race and changing demographics and multiple cultures. So say a bit about, you know, what, how that sprung into your heart and life from your real life in Orange County, California, what you're studying, because that's a good segue then into how you and I started talking, and then about you becoming canon for racial diversity and justice. So yeah, tell everybody what sparked your study and what you're studying.
Yeah, well, that's a great question. I think maybe it was about a dozen years ago. I feel like it was, I'm getting my dates all confused, but maybe 2012 was around the time in which I've been a local church pastor all my adult life. Mm-hmm. We were beginning to see, through largely because of things like social media, as it was becoming common, mm-hmm. in our churches, all these incredibly difficult scenes of especially Black men and women and children suffering in ways that we haven't seen before. So I'm thinking of Trayvon Martin. I'm thinking mm-hmm. of what happened with Mike Garner. And these issues became issues that I realized, well, we need to be able to pray for these things. We need to do something about them. We need to do something with them and have conversations. As I was talking to my, especially my Black friends who were helping me understand how they felt and how they were mm-hmm. navigating. And I found it really hard to have a holding space for that in the church. Like, we just simply did not know, at least in the church that I was, and I realized later on that we weren't alone, what to do with these conversations. And so that began my search and longing and heart to say, what is the heart of God for racial justice as we're encountering them in our world? And the more I looked and the more I learned, the more I listened, I began to realize this is one of the biggest, I think, missional moments. Like, in order for us to do mission well in our times, I think this is one of the ways in which we need to understand what's going on in our world. So that's what began my study. And so I wound up changing around the orientation my entire DMin at that time, and wrote on race, evangelicalism, and the local church. It sounds like an encyclopedia, sort of a...
Now everybody knows why I tapped you to be the canon for racial diversity right. and justice. There's the answer right there.
Well, it was a ridiculous title, and
it was aspirational.
Definitely aspirational, but I think somewhere in there was a desire to do some good yeah. within that intersection of those three.
And then just give people who don't understand a brief orientation of what you do as canon for racial diversity and justice.
Yeah, you know, Todd, one of the things that I tell people is that I'm extremely uncomfortable with titles, and especially a title that I don't fully understand nor appreciate for sure.
You think you're like a really big gun or something?
Yeah, somebody called me a loose cannon. And I said, well, I think that I understand.
That's so funny.
I don't quite understand the whole very reverend versus, you know, reverend,
yes.
all those kind
that's
of things.
That's right. It makes you very yeah. reverend.
Yeah.
Yes. Tell so, the kids that's right.
that. The next time the kids tell you you can't do music, just tell them, well, I'm very
At
reverend.
At least you're very
yes,
reverend.
Yes, I'm
yeah.
very reverend. You know, and of course, they're teenagers, so I get plenty of
yeah,
sarcasm.
They care less, they right? will, yeah.
yes. That is so yeah. funny. So,
yeah. I think the best way I've been thinking about, like, instead of like going through like the 7 or 8 points that we yeah. have labeled or we have been thinking about in terms of our work, is to think about it as creating two sorts of spaces. One is I think we are responsible and we want to help create safe spaces to advocate, mm-hmm. support, and really be a listening space for people of color who are within our congregations, within our clergy, in the process mm-hmm. of becoming clergy. So we want to create a safe space so that people feel cared for. But the other thing is to also create a courageous space, a brave space for people mm-hmm. to, so that we can, as a diocese, have these difficult, sometimes adversarial almost mm-hmm. conversations about yeah. race and justice. And I don't know why I'm not saying that it should be adversarial, but sometimes it feels like that. And I think it feels at times like it is more difficult than it ought to be. But nevertheless, yeah. we need to step into these spaces with courage.
Yeah. And we'll put mm-hmm. a link in the show note to your page on our website.
Yeah. Thank you for sharing, Jen. Before we get into sort of the framework of how we enter into these conversations, maybe it would be helpful for you and your expertise to kind of show us or talk to us about why these conversations or these issues of race, changing demographics, multiple cultures, why do they cause conflict? And that's kind of broad, but maybe if you could just help us narrow that down and why we see that conflict playing out and not just in our culture, but even within our churches.
Yeah, and especially within the context of churches, sometimes it feels like it creates more conflict than outside of the churches. Mm-hmm. I mean, there's conflict everywhere. Let's start with that. Whenever we talk about race nowadays, it feels like there's no like neutral, easygoing space. Yeah.
Right.
That's quickly disappearing, mm-hmm. or if it hasn't disappeared already. I think about it a little bit of, learning to speak about something that's difficult to talk about, but that's mm-hmm. Requires practice. You know, if you have, and lots of people do this sort of self work and understanding the self within C4SO. When you first start to talk about who you are, both the good and the bad, it's really hard. I stumble mm-hmm. over my words. I am surprisingly defensive. I'm surprisingly making excuses for things for other people or for myself in ways that feels super awkward at the beginning. And I wonder, and I think it's very much like that in terms of talking about race issues for people who have been trained. And we have been trained for the most part in the church to not talk about racial issues in many of our spaces, not in all spaces, like in certain traditions, it's very normal for them to talk about race and justice, these conversations. It's very normal. So this isn't like to say that this happens everywhere for sure. But in some of our spaces, especially in vast swaths of American evangelicalism or churches that come from that sort of a background, this is not a conversation that you have. And it's kind of like going to the doctor once a year, and the doctor says, okay, you got lots of things that you need to work on, and you got like high cholesterol, you got like your sugar levels are way high. You need to do these things. And it feels like, oh my gosh, like, you know, what do I do? And you feel the response for me is often kind of like panic, paralysis, and shock, right?
Yeah.
And I don't think if we do this as this occasional thing reactively to the news events, I don't think we'll ever get past that. But if we consider this as part of our formational work of what it means to be a church, I think we can do this work better. So one of the things that I actually realized I wrote about this in my dissertation is that there's a certain posture that we can have that helps us to have these conversations more naturally. One of the ways, three positions from which we need to be thinking about who we are and how to have these conversations is, one is as an insider. One is as a member of something that we love. So we can talk about these things using insider's language. So I encourage people to not bring in frameworks and language from outside, but rather to talk about, well, what does the Bible, what does the gospel say? What do you hear Jesus saying in this text? Ask those questions. What does the Book of Common Prayer help us to pray? Mm-hmm. And really begin to ask those questions and using that language. But the other part is to say these are like spatial postures. One is as an insider, but the other part is as being on the margins. To have some sort of prophetic learning, you need to learn from the margins. You need to be listening. You need to be empathetic to what's going on, whether you are experiencing that for yourself or because you long to serve and you will learn to grow from the people from the margins. And you need to be doing that work. And I think, you know, that's part of all of our work, right? So I've seen that as very much part of everyone's growth. As they get more, quote unquote, comfortable with having these conversations, you need to learn from the margins, or you need to be able to speak from your marginalized experiences. I would love to ask you guys how you guys have experienced that, as because I see a lot of nodding and I think it's important.
So the things that you're saying make me think about a couple of things. It makes me think about Wes Hill and how he says ignoring is not the path to redeeming. And so it's just so important to be able to put yourself in a position to listen to those who are marginalized, but also if you've experienced that yourself, being able to share how that made you feel and your experience with that, because I think there are folks who just kind of go through life and not even realize that these are brothers and sisters who are going through these things or have experienced prejudice or racism or whatever, and just not even know it. And so when we avoid these issues that potentially cause conflict, we're not actually redeeming any of it. And so I like what you're saying, that we need to be in a posture of being on our way to have conversations, and we need to be willing to also open up as well. And then another thing that made me think about what you're saying is you made the distinction between using insider language, because we are dealing with these issues as Christians, right? The world is having this important conversation, culture is, but we see things with a different vantage point, right? Through the lens of the kingdom and Christ, and what does Jesus have to say about these things? And he really does have a lot to say. So the things that you're saying kind of make my mind go to that space is we have this view of people as Christians, like image of God, that sort of thing. And it really shapes the way that we should be willing to have these conversations, even if they cause conflict or are uncomfortable. So I don't know, yeah. Bishop Todd, what else would you say about that?
Well, when I look at you and, you know, thinking of Travis, your husband, and you guys being working pastors in Tampa, and then I see Jen on my screen, who in a sense is, you know, our expert in this, it makes me think, Jen, as you've done your work in the diocese with people like Travis and Mickey and other clergy, are there common points of conflict that you see, or common points of conflict that people are afraid of in terms of trying to get into these conversations?
Let me scale that back, though, because I think one of the things that happened when the church refused to enter into these difficult conversations, right? That we say, oh, this is bringing up a lot of tension. We don't want to promote disunity by talking about contentious topics like race. What happens when the church does that is, people don't just stop talking about it. They just learn to talk about it from other spaces. We just have ceded, the church ceded space to form people to have these conversations well. And this is why what happens, I think, is you have all sorts of framework issues. So people come in with framework that has been formed. They have been formed and discipled in other spaces and not from the church. And the pastors find it even more difficult because they haven't really done the work because they felt like it's not their responsibility. Yeah. But one of the things that I think we're trying to say is that this is part and parcel of what it means to preach the good news of Jesus Christ in our times. Mm. You know, how do we talk about our neighbor without having a conversation about what makes our neighborhood the way it is?
Yeah.
You know, how do we do this without asking those questions? Because that's exactly the sort of question that Jesus asked of us.
Yeah. Mm. You know, our mutual friend, Dr. Greg Thompson, I remember him saying to me a couple of years ago, 2 or 3 years ago, that he thought that if we could learn to address issues of race and these, you know, sort of social systematic things, that it was actually like the opportunity of our moment to do mission, or, you know what I mean, to be Christians in the public square, and precisely to not just try to talk about these things redemptively, but to be agents of healing as well. So, Jen, let's pivot to the three things we want to talk about today, more specifically, so race and then changing demographics and multiple cultures. So as well as we know each other, I don't think we've ever had a sustained discussion about this, but I just thought this would be a good question to help, especially white people or majority cultures of any kind, to understand how race can be real. And I just have this vague recollection of, I don't know, you and I having lunch or something, and you explaining to me, or at least saying something about what it meant to be an Asian American male during COVID, when there was so much anti-Asian rhetoric. What do you remember about that? What would you say about it that is a kind of a beginning explainer of issues of race?
Yeah, wow. Painful memories,
right? Oh, sorry,
because
man.
It is a reminder, you know, people talked about COVID times as an unveiling, yeah. right? Of
yeah.
things that were always present.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
you, because of our situation or our times, it had unveiled things, and things were laid naked, and we saw things laid out. And one of the things that I think we saw, we experienced as a family, and I live in a part of California where it's actually a huge Asian American population. But even with lots and lots of diversity, it did not create actual understanding and mutuality and empathy, because one of the things that happened during COVID that I had to have conversations with my kids about was just how our, as a Korean American family, as an Asian American man and women, kids, that in certain spaces that our existence was in some ways as citizens of America were somewhat conditional. Because it was so strange to me how quickly my kids were confused by people saying things like, go back to where you came from. Like where, or blaming, like, or bunching together of all of these problems in this difficult racist rhetoric. And that's part of, I actually, I'm going to go back to something that I actually asked of you at the beginning before the recording, which is to, even as a softball question, to not start out by talking about my Korean culture.
Yeah.
Because for the Asian American experience in America, Asian American experience in America has been this sense of being a perpetual foreigner. You know, you could trace back Asian American existence to the continental U.S., to times before America, U.S. was ever a country many hundreds of years before that. And even in Southern California, if you think about that, you were talking in a continual communities like 150 years. Right. But there are days in which we are still seen as a foreigner, as an outsider.
Yeah.
My kids who have known nothing but, you know, they're born in Newport Beach, Southern California. Yeah. They're like Southern California as anything. You know, we had an experience of people asking, like, do they speak English? And like, they only speak English.
Yeah. Right. Yeah,
don't tell their grandparents, right?
Exactly. Don't tell their grandparents. And so those are kind of experiences that we have. And so, I remember having a conversation with a very good friend of mine who is a white man, we're just about the same age. We went to college together. And he talked about an experience, and we happened to live in Irvine together. And he explained about how he had an interaction that made him become very conscious of his whiteness and made him feel very uncomfortable. And he shared that with me, asking me about my insights to help him understand. You do this work, Jen, and help me to understand how I should, how I can navigate this. And I said, well, you know, that experience of you becoming aware of your racedness, of having culture, is what I experience every moment of my existence, right? Having just walked into a coffee shop, and in ways that he will never understand that, and, you know, we just walked into a coffee shop, and I said, did you ever notice how when you and I, we walk together into the coffee shop, almost always they think they talk to you first. Did you ever notice how, when somebody stops by, they look at you and they don't look at me directly in the eye? And these kind of things that I pointed out in terms of my everyday, every moment existence. And it was actually a really great moment, because it was a time he gave me an opportunity to share about my experience. And this is sort of what you just did, Todd, to say, you know, I don't know if we had a conversation like this. And this is hard sometimes, even for somebody whose job is to do this for a living. Because so many times we are in spaces in which we are not believed and or dismissed as something else, and these stories. So I want to encourage people to be able to say these stories, but it also needs to be in a safe space, in a place where I can act in courage and the other person can receive in courage empathetically.
Yeah.
So that's, I think, one of the things that I'm hopeful for and wanting to create within our diocese.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Nice.
Yeah. That sounds like a great friend who trusted you and was in humility, was open about that. And I think that's such a great avenue for you to share your insight. And I think that's something people should be doing, and inviting us to speak into those moments.
Yeah. It's a great gift of mutuality, right? And and he wanted to listen. He invited me to tell my story. Would you share with me your insights? And from that point on, to be honest, I mean, we've had some harder conversations.
Sure,
but
sure.
It built on it. And we need that sort of building. We can't, you know, start. And I think that's exactly the sort of a thing that I see in terms of churches. The more you can just do the work of, you know, it's like exercising. It's like learning a language. It's like you just have to step into it, and it's going to feel awkward, and it's going to be painful, and you're going to hurt yourself at first. And there will have to be apologies. And there will have to, but if we step into it with humility, I've seen some beautiful conversations and fruit grow because of that.
Yeah. That's so good. And I think solidarity too, because like we talked about before, some folks are just not aware of the things that people of color
experience, the tensions, the hostility, sometimes the racism flat out. Yeah, I think it really does bring awareness so that our white brothers and sisters can stand with us. I remember when Travis and I, early on in our marriage, I was talking to him about some of the things that I had experienced that I now have come to understand were actually like microaggressions growing up my whole life as a Latin American girl. And I was telling him this story about my dad used to work for this company, and he worked in like just a sales represented or a customer service, something like that. In the United States, this was maybe 15 years ago, we're US citizens at the time. But my father has an accent, because he came to the States as an adult. And so he learned English pretty well, but has a pretty thick accent. And, he was helping someone on the line, and they said, I want to speak to someone in America. And he was like, oh, that joke's on you. I am in America. I'm in Florida. And they were like, no, I want someone who like speaks English. As he's speaking English, albeit with an accent, but you mentioned this like conditional, this condition on being American. And that's just so true. And I remember telling my husband that, and he was just like, I can't believe that. And I'm like, well, you better believe it, because this stuff happens, and it happens today. Right. And so he's just been so gracious and processing this stuff with me now, like as I talk about my experiences with him and looking back, and he's helped me really identify those things that I experienced. And so he, of course, is like, well, I'm in solidarity with you and your dad and all sorts of people who come to this country, and are still kind of treated like they're conditional Americans. So,
yeah.
So great.
Thank you so much for sharing that, Mickey. And I know we talked about stories with your parents and growing up. Mm-hmm. And it's so formative in ways. And I think sometimes there are these stories of pain, but I know we also talked about in the context of how much it fed us, how beautiful it was also to have this other culture that fed to an understanding. And I mean that in the biggest spiritual sense of the sort of vision, our appreciation for the bigness of God, I think I might want to say grows because of our cultural vantage points, because of that. And we see God working in bigger ways in some ways. And there's a great beauty to that. And I know we talked a lot about that as well. So thank you for sharing that.
Yeah, absolutely. And kind of while we're on this, you know, in this vein, what we are having these important conversations as a culture. Obviously, I think that's important. And like we said before, we as Christians, we have even more reason to have these conversations. So how do we distinctively talk about these issues of race and diversity as Christians specifically?
You know, oftentimes when you have these things, you talk about all the resources. There are wonderful resources out there to help us. That's for sure. But the resource that I really do want to ask for our clergy especially, but are all of our church members to really point to is that I really want to point them to is what we have already, the Bible, our liturgy. I talk about, you know, if you think about Acts 2, and I know you guys actually went through a series of podcasts on the Pentecost, and the Pentecost moment in Acts 2 is such an important, beautiful reminder of how I think we ought to be thinking about difference, because there's that moment. So first of all, I think a place of generosity that welcomes all. And what the transformation that happens is not beforehand, but as we are receiving in our brokenness, right? As God's grace changes us. And I think the Eucharist table, and if you know, of course, the story of what Paul has to deal with in Corinthians about how people understood people misunderstood and the one correction that he makes about the Eucharist is that we misunderstood this thing as an exclusive thing, but rather that the Paul teaches us is like, this is the gift of God. Mm-hmm. This is one thing that equalizes. This is a thing that equalizes above anything else. And we are meant to share that hospitality. What does it look like for us then to turn around and be that for somebody else? I think about that.
Yeah.
I also think about one thing I always point out is when we have these fearful moments of like, well, does it mean that we have to talk about sin that I don't even understand? It's like, gosh. In our Anglican liturgy, you know, confession is there, and we pray the confession whether or not we felt like we sinned that week or not, or we're conscious of what specific sin that we ought to be confessing, right? So, and I think if we have that posture, I think the confession tells us that we ought to be humble and to know that we are not God. And that it's okay that if we are wrong about things, or it's okay if we are short-sighted about certain things, that we can definitely experience the love of God.
Yeah. So we got a couple more topics for you, Jen. Well, for the sake of time, we'll move a little quicker on. The next one is changing demographics. And I'm never sure. You hear different dates about when America is supposed to become, majority non-white. So best figures I could find this morning was somewhere around 2040, 2045. And that's not the important part. The important part is whether you hear it in politics today or sociology or demographics or, whatever, you might hear it in lots of different ways. Just a lot of smart people are saying that at least the white world is reacting to this, reacting to the ever sort of colorization, you might say, of our country. And then, at least a couple of patterns of pushback that I see are nativism, which just technically means, protecting the native born or the majority population is a common response. And then I think one that's not so thoughtful, it's more like in our people's hearts and souls, is xenophobia, which is technically that term means a fear of a foreigner or fear of the other. And like Jesus is calling us to neighborly love and all this stuff is swirling around. So as you work with our churches and clergy and laity, how are you getting at trying to help people deal with changing demographics?
Yeah, well, that's a huge topic that we need to, there's a lot of history and context to that. I mean, there is some aspects of it that touches upon really honestly Christian nationalism that goes back to the sense that our identity as Christians are somehow intertwined with our preservation of a Christian culture in the U.S. and how we how doing that somehow glorifies God. And so that's a problematic theological position that I think most of us are aware of. And I remember, right, I tell people that I'm a product of American evangelicalism, but white evangelicalism as much as anybody else. I went to all the conferences. I got all the emails, or before emails.
Read all the books.
all the books. Right. Went to the schools. Yeah. Got my, I'm speaking like Paul to say I got my creds, street creds as an evangelical. And so much of those fears were just kind of like, it's been a long time in making, right? The sense of nativism as well as xenophobia. And I just, when you step back and again, looking back to the scriptures, I just don't see that. And I think we need to be able to talk about these things well. And, what does it look like to really be honest about what does it mean for us to serve our neighbors, love our neighbor. When you look at that story of the Good Samaritan, when Jesus tells and has that incredible conversation about loving your neighbor, like who is your neighbor? Jesus asks, it is really about like boundary crossing, boundary bridging. Right. Mm-hmm. And Jesus is saying that, do you really think that does it really make sense for you to define your neighbor by your ethnicity or even the sense of eliteness that you sense about yourself? Or do you really think that God may have had something more generous in mind? Mm-hmm. And I think that challenge is right there by Jesus. And, you know, we've heard one of the things that we've heard nowadays, and we were at a conference this weekend, Bishop Todd, you and I, where yeah. somebody talked about the experience of somebody preaching the Beatitudes and someone coming up and saying, "That's weak. That's not good enough."
Yeah. Yeah, yeah, yeah. You know? Yeah.
I don't know what to do with that. Mm. But if there are people that are not driven by fear and are still committed to doing this work with Jesus, I think there are ways in which we can be humble. And I think there are ways in which we could use language that doesn't trigger, but then that can go under the defensiveness, because it's our language. It's our language. It's our liturgy. You know, we can talk about structural racism because we have an understanding in which Jesus talks about these things. We have an understanding of making confessions, even if it's not something that we specifically intended, because we have these confessions in our liturgy. We come together in ways to say that we need to be shaped beyond what we fully can appreciate in the moment. And I think that's what I would turn to. And yeah. I would say that there are plenty of resources within. And I do think it needs to be pushed. We need to be pushed to tap into those resources well by speaking and being discipled and learning from a marginal voices and spaces and being empathetic listeners to them.
Yeah.
Yeah. The whole other fun conversation for another day, Jen, but as you were talking, I was just picturing the people in Jesus's crowds who were Herodians and that was their neighbor, or zealots and that was their neighbor, or, you know, part of the Qumran and that was their neighbor, or even just their neighborhood. And yeah. you're right. It's such a radical redefinition of what it means to love, to will the good. In one of my books, maybe it was in Deep Peace, I think I had a chapter on xenophobia, and then I kind of coined a word, had a chapter on xenophilia. Like, how can we move from fear of the other to a more innate love of the other, which is what I think I hear you calling us to. So, Mickey, let's finish up with multiple cultures.
Yeah. So Jen, what would you say are some of the challenges of multiculturalism, and why do you think some people celebrate it and others see it as destructive to the coherence of a society? Can you talk to us a little bit more about that?
I'll do my best. Boy, that's another, like,
a little loaded, but
come on, you're Professor Jen here. We're counting on you.
I would go back to our original name that we had for our team that had been doing this work, which Bishop Todd, you gave to us, Revelation 7:9. This, yeah. And I would start out with the vision that drives us, a vision of multiculturalism that is beautiful, not threatening, not to be feared. Mm-hmm. And this is God's vision that we talked about that drives us forward and gives us hope and gives us a challenge at the same time. And I would say very briefly that this is something that we need to embrace as God's beautiful kingdom vision of multiculturalism.
You just made a major move that I want to make sure everybody sitting in their car or walking or whatever hears, that multiculturalism is not of first importance, like a sociological response. It's not about anthropology. It's not about a current political spirit. That the multiculturalism we're talking about is rooted in this divine vision. That's a major move.
because it takes you out of the cultural angst into, like you said, something more beautiful. Now, that doesn't mean we don't have to work through the cultural angst, but we're not stuck there because we've got this vision. That's a major move. Thank you.
Well, this is a conversation that we've had many times over, Bishop Todd, about how the vision really needs to be in place and we need to catch God's vision. Without that, we are going to be people who are going to be searching and grasping for frameworks from left and right. But I think
another great word. Thank you.
Yeah,
that vision becomes the framework through which we talk about these things, not current politics or whatever.
Yes. And so there's that resistance for me to say, I am going to just annoy people to the left or to the right, but I am going to be fully convictional on this. And we've had many conversations about what it means for people to be fully convictional and be humble and be empathetic to learning. And this is one of the ways in which I think other positions for me, it's just, there's a limit of what you can do with other positions. Like you could only be in, as a church, I'm talking about as a church, be in a silo, and create more echo chambers rather than create a learning hospitable space.
So Jen, if you think back over the work you've been doing for a number of years now, and as you are a pretty careful observer of what's going on in current culture, like if you had a magic wand or something, I don't know how quite to ask this, if you could get the attention of our clergy and lay people, what's the one element you think right now that you'd love us to be paying attention to? Is there a certain element that's either like first or most, first in a sequence or first in terms of most crucial? Like I'm just thinking of somebody who's listening and going, I don't know where to start. Like, what's a good place to start?
That's a hard question. You prepped me a little bit about asking this question. I've been thinking a lot about this, but one question that I've been asking of myself regularly that feels helpful to me, and I think hopefully this will hit other people in different ways as well, is courage. What does it look like for us to step into this work in courage? Because it requires courage from all of us. And if you are thinking like, man, I don't know how to do this without like making a mistake or making a goof or somebody yelling at me because I did it wrong, whether it's from the right or the left or whoever, whether it's a white person yelling at them or a person of color yelling at them. Lots of fear drive the opposition to this work, I think. And I would just say we have to learn to overcome that at certain point.
Yeah.
I think one of the prayers that I learned during COVID times that I continue to pray for myself is to ask the Lord nearly every day, Lord, what is the courageous conversation that I need to step into today? And I think that might be something in a different way for different people, that it's something that can be a prayer that others can adapt for their own use.
It sounds like you've made it into something like a spiritual discipline or a part of your rule of life. Am I hearing you right?
Absolutely. Because you can't, right? This is hard work, right? Yeah. And both of you have experienced in your own ways, the sort of pushback and the emotional toll that it can take. I try to remember that it is not an optional conversation for many people. While when I want to step away from some of these conversations, I try to remember that.
Yeah.
And I try to remember that, that someone needs to be doing this work. But absolutely, in order for you to do this, you can't do it with like this sense of willpower, right? It has to be formational. It's just your weakness is personal weakness is going to catch up to you otherwise. And I think learning to depend on the Spirit has been the thing that drives me.
So as we kind of close out and leave our listeners with something really great to chew on. What is something that is filling you with hope today when you think about all the stuff that we've talked about, when you look at the world around us? What is filling you with hope for us, for our diocese, and for our future?
Yeah. I'm going to be rather obvious about this one and just say young people. I'm going to say my kids.
Yeah. Just because it's obvious doesn't mean it's untrue, Jen.
Yeah.
Yeah.
No,
yeah.
They do drive me. And I hear the way they talk about some of these things, the way my kids have conversations about how they have incorporated the gospel of love and justice together, that these things work hand in hand, that for them there is no division, that the way in which they learn to love is also to the way in which they act justly and to do justice. I see it among their population, a longing for it. Now, what do we do with that as a church is a challenge to us as a church, right? What do we do with that? And I think that's a real deep challenge. Do we kind of dismiss them, or do we learn from them? I think that's what we're being called to today. But yeah, my kids and their generation.
You. I love that.
Yeah.
All right. Thank you, Mickey. Good to be working with you again. And Jen, great to see you as always. Thanks for being with us today.
Yes. Thank you, Jen. Well,
thank you both.
Thanks so much for tuning in to the C4SO podcast. If you like what you heard, please feel free to share this episode and subscribe and leave a review. It helps us to get the word out. Thanks.